Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 6, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the second of two talks on the Arya Parayasana Sutta. This talk begins with a Sangha discussion on the previous week's talk on this sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
I know I left you all speechless last Tuesday, but what do you think about the first half of this sutta and the message that's there?
I think it's very interesting. I'm so glad it's all of these that get, you know, come through time.
Yeah.
I mean, without it, it's, you know, mankind wouldn't be as rich as it is.
Yeah, it's certainly.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, and the understanding what the Buddha taught and why he taught it. And, I mean, that's what this sutta is really about, is how he came to the conclusions that he did. And really why he taught an Eightfold Path. I got an interesting question from someone online today about the use of, just the use of the word Eightfold and what it means, and how, why are the truths noble truths. The reference to, there's a few reasons, but the primary reason for Eightfold is as opposed to a Onefold. A fold in that sense means a multiple of something. And so it's a multiple of, it's eight multiples of single practices, isn't it, that results in an Eightfold Path, to emphasize that it's not a Onefold Path, that it's not just meditation. And when you think about most of the lineages during the Buddha's time and during our time were Onefold. In other words, they had a single purpose, such as worship of a deity, such as rituals being the path, such as just meditation being the path. And that's really reflected today too. So that's the brilliance of it, is that the Buddha, as we'll learn tonight, the Buddha attained his awakened state through jhana, but that's, he taught much more than that, didn't he? Based on the experiences that he had during his search for awakening.
Right, because he basically, the two teachers taught jhana number 2 and 3 or 3 and 4.
Yeah, to me it's hard to even classify. I would say that they taught really two, up to a directed thought, and that directed thought was, let me hold in mind nothingness, or either perception or non-perception, and even the evaluation part of that, that is, the Buddha asks both of them the direct question, is that the culmination of your Dhamma? Which means, how do you evaluate it? And they said, yeah, that's it. And they said, that's not it yet. You know. And then even in this sutta, we'll learn that the Buddha said that he developed jhana, implying at a much deeper level than he had from those other teachers. And then when you tie it in with the Nagara Sutta and how he relates that to the Eightfold Path, and even hear how he thought, it's a really remarkable sutta.
He doesn't say what kind of meditation, what actual meditation was taught by these two teachers, whether it was awareness of the breath meditation or not. No, because later on he says that this is something he came up with himself as a child.
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that when I get into it in this sutta. There's no way of really knowing what Alarakalama or Rudaka Ramaputta actually taught as a meditation practice, but the common practice was to just be quiet, you know, and just whatever method you might use to do that. That was called meditation. But like today, a lot of it was more contemplation than meditation. And so you could see that Alarakalama's practice is similar to the insight movement today, in that you first quiet your mind by being mindful of your breath, and then you look, you leave that behind, and you look to gain a very broad application of insight, meaning insight into everything. So those two teachers are teaching, in a little bit of speculation on my part, to first quiet your mind and then establish yourself or gain insight into the dimension of nothingness, or neither, et cetera, et cetera. So again, very similar to what's occurring right now.
Is that considered ignoble?
Yeah, that's part of the ignoble search, only because it doesn't leads to nobility. Meaning, why this gentleman asked me. Actually, I can't tell if there was a gentleman or a lady because of the name. Why is it called noble truths? Well, in the Buddha's terminology, understood in the context, noble meant someone who understood the Dhamma. They were noble in their thinking. Their thinking surpassed everything else. And so these truths are not just a truth such as the sun rises and sets every day. They're a noble truth in that they lead to awakening. And there's other terminology too. Noble also means that it withstands the test of time. Hi, Helen.
Hello,
good to see you.
And then there's the fact that the word Arya is connected to, you know, the Aryans. That was kind of the noble race that came into India and displaced the lower indigenous people there.
But, and also seen, though, as simply not related to the Aryan race, but in a Arya Pariyasana Sutta can be seen as the greater. Almost if it was called Maha Pariyasana Sutta would be more appropriate, but it means the same thing.
Right.
You know, that it's the greater teacher, the greater teaching on Pariyasana, on noble and ignoble searches. And so we learn through this sutta and many of the others that being able to distinguish between what's a noble search and an ignoble search is a core foundational understanding that the Buddha taught. We have to be able to see it if we're going to practice it and know what not to practice. And when you boil that all down, the Eightfold Path really is a simple and direct path, isn't it? With many themes to consider within that simple path. But it also helps avoid grasping after things that aren't part of his Dhamma that would be very difficult to let go of. Liz.
So when you're calling it a jhana, and it sounded as if once you've gained insight into all the different things they're discussing, you know, the non-clinging, they're not coming to me right now, but so when you're talking about them in the context of jhana, that means you have reached a certain enlightenment about that, whatever that element is. Is that the way I was reading it down with each paragraph, and it would say.
You mean the four levels of jhana,
yeah.
And ending in that that place of peaceful abiding,
mm-hmm.
that is established. So what that's, and again, jhana really only relates to, jhana relates to a proper meditation practice, meaning the focus of that practice, to deepen concentration, and then off our cushions or off out of our meditation sessions, from that well-concentrated mind, we know what to hold in mind. Again, it speaks directly to this sutta, but also in general to the Dhamma. What to hold in mind, you've heard me say this often and always on retreat, what we learn through the Buddha's Dhamma is just as important to know what to let go of, what to abandon as it is to know what to hold on to, what to bring into our mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Eightfold Path sense, it is holding in mind the Eightfold Path. When the Buddha teaches mindfulness in that way, in relation to the Eightfold Path, he teaches that it is being mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path is the path. In other words, to recognize when I'm in wrong view, to enter and remain, or to hold in mind what I know is right view, and et cetera, throughout the all eight factors of the Eightfold Path.
So when you use the term jhana, how does that hold those elements in context? Is it holding it at a higher level?
In fact, it's not holding those at all in meditation. It's such an important question you ask. So meditation isn't to to develop non-clinging and hold on to that is okay. In my mind now, I'm non-clinging. It's not that. It's developing freedom from craving for and clinging to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths through concentration. Because it's an aspect of a mind rooted in ignorance to be constantly distracted away from seeing your own ignorance. You heard me say that often these powerful and subtle strategies that we all create to ignore our own ignorance. And they all seem reasonable, don't they? That's a distraction. These powerful and subtle strategies are a distraction. The Buddha could almost as accurately describe the First Noble Truth as there is dukkha as saying there is distraction. Because it's a mind rooted in ignorance that is constantly prone towards distraction. And how does a mind rooted in ignorance fulfill distraction moment by moment? Through constant sensory indulgence. How else would it be that a mind and body would seek distraction except through its own senses? I like this, I don't like this, I need more of that, I don't like this, I'm so worried about the election, I can't wait till I get my new red car. Why did that person look at me? This whole endless and really endless list of distractions that we attach ourselves to are the antithesis of an awakened mind. So jhana, in its culmination, as the Buddha used with Alara Kalama, is concentration. It's not establishment in any non-physical realm, as we learned last week. It's not an establishment in any context, such as compassion or love or engagement or the environment or anything else.
The Bodhisattva vow, right?
Or, thank you for bringing that up, or the Bodhisattva vow. And isn't it interesting that the Bodhisattva path is the primary path for most modern Buddhists, which the Buddha recognized as a distraction. A high calling for a human being to be imbued with compassion for other human beings. But if that's all that there is, it's usually used as a distraction. And as we know, there's been a lot of things done in the name of compassion, or maybe, you know, just to make the correlation, in the name of God, that have proven to be very hurtful towards people, haven't they? And that's not to say everything.
And again, ignoble.
And so it's ignoble, because it doesn't get to the point. The Buddhist, the only point that he was hoping to get to, as described as right view, is understanding stress, understanding the origination of stress, having the experience of the cessation of stress, and developing the Eightfold Path as the path leading to the cessation of stress. All of it rooted in jhana. All of it rooted in concentration. So any meditation method that is substituted for a concentration practice is not part of what the Buddha taught, and it won't support the entire Eightfold Path. That's the method. That's the message in this method. in this sutta, and really all the other suttas that the Buddha taught. Liz, did I answer your question?
Yeah.
And it's so fundamental. I say it often. We meditate to deepen concentration. Period. Not for deepen concentration and then we can do this and do that. And then off our cushion, as we integrate the entire Eightfold Path, and as situations arise in our moment-by-moment life, then that is how we develop the entire Eightfold Path. So I think that since we've had such a great discussion, would it be okay if we continue the discussion, I give the talk, and we meditate at the end of class?
Sure.
That's okay with everyone? Kevin?
Just to go on with that, I mean, this sutta has... You left me speechless last week, but you didn't this week.
Good.
Yeah, there's a lot in this second half of this. And, you know, what you were just saying is this, to recognize the subtlety of these states of jhana, you know, and that's what he talks about here. And,
yeah.
And that's the concentration is needed for that. You know, you need to have that well-concentrated mind to understand or to see these states.
Yeah.
To develop that color body. It's just really vivid and descriptive, this particular sutta. So
yeah.
Really
thank you for saying that. It's the essence of shamatha vipassana meditation to deepen concentration. And if we engage in a practice that, and the Buddha mentioned it last week in this sutta and again this week in the second half, beyond the skillful desire, chanda, to awaken, any other aspect of grasping for or clinging to that's introduced or becomes part of our dhamma practice, in this case I use the word dharma practice, we're lost. Because whenever there's grasping, another word for grasping is desire. Remember how the Buddha, when there's desire, there's fear. When there's fear, there's constant distraction, isn't there? And sometimes it's a very subtle fear. But when we start substituting other teachings, again, this is, I think I probably get you all pretty upset when I keep saying this. And I know that some people have left coming here, and to me that's unfortunate, because they don't like me hearing me say over and over again, it's this and it's not that. But it's so important, because our minds want to be distracted. You could really say that the whole world has developed very powerful ways to keep us distracted. The most of the money in the world flows towards individuals and institutions that can distract us. Most of it, not all of it, but most of it does. I mean, think about that. Some of the highest paid people in our country, at least, and really all over the world, are those that can entertain us. Entertainment is another word for that, would be distraction. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't, you know, listen to wonderful singers, whatever we might choose as entertainment, doesn't mean we shouldn't engage in it. I'm just making the point. They get the bulk of our money, don't they? Because they satisfy this need for distraction. This last series of talks on jhana, and this is really a talk on jhana too, you'll see when I get to it, it's just to completely... completely is the wrong word. To consistently emphasize, this is what we do in Dhamma practice. We deepen concentration so that we can incorporate the Eightfold Path. So we have that presence of mind, that level of well-concentrated mindfulness to do that. So, boy, what a good discussion already. Let me give the talk and we'll meditate at the end. We used to do that occasionally anyway before. So last week we looked at and heard from the Buddha his search with two very specific teachers, but he also studied with other teachers too. They weren't the only two teachers that the Buddha encountered. These were the most significant to the Buddha, and I think one of the reasons is because in recounting his experience with them, he could use that story to say to those that he's teaching now, that whenever you try to establish yourself in any type of non-physical realm, it's rooted in fabrication, and taken in context of the suttas on jhana, it's simply to be seen that way. There's nothing, it's not even a higher form of fabrication. All fabrications are rooted in ignorance. They're to be recognized and abandoned. So, and in this sutta, the Buddha doesn't get into recounting his severe ascetic practices that he developed over the years. It's simply not part of the sutta. And he also, and I'm going to get to this right away, now the Buddha is going to describe his awakening experience during jhana. And notice, and I've told the story, the metaphorical story of the Buddha's awakening with Mara coming down and challenging him, etc., etc. I think I'm going to stop teaching that because it's just confusing, and it doesn't relate well to what the Buddha actually teaches in the sutta. And by the way, there is no sutta that like that. Well, there's one that's similar to it. But it's taught very clearly that this is a story. Here the Buddha's recounting his real experience and leaving out for the most part metaphor, but there's a little bit of it in here. So the Buddha has left Uddaka Ramaputta and Alara Kalama, saying that this doesn't lead to my goal of understanding. And then he continues, seeking the unexcelled peace arising from skillful understanding, I wandered through the Magadhan country and arrived in Uruvela. This place was delightful, with inspiring forests, a clear flowing river with shallow banks, and nearby villages for alms. This seemed just right for developing jhana, for developing concentration. So the Buddha might have decided that he's going to leave out some of these other stories, such as maybe Sujata, who in the other telling of the Buddha's awakening, he passed out from the severe ascetic practices and she rolled down into a river, Sujata, a 12-year-old girl, pulled him out of the river and nursed him back to health. It's an interesting story, and it may or may not be true, but even as I said it, is it relevant to what the Buddha's teaching? Not really, is it? So the Buddha left it out, and that's why I'm thinking, maybe I should too. This place, this pleasant abiding seemed just right for developing jhana. Friends, while practicing jhana, being subject to birth, to sickness, to aging, to death, to sorrow, regret, pain, distress, despair, to greed, to aversion, to delusion, I realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. That is so significant because the Buddha's teaching those that were listening to him and us today that awakening occurs from wherever you are. In other words, he's not saying, I did this, I did that, I did a different rituals, I imagined myself in a different plane, I prayed to this God or that God, and awakening was bestowed on me. I started where I was, rooted in ignorance. And from that place, through the right method, I realized the unborn, the unexcelled release of the yoke. The yoke means being tied to views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the unbinding. Knowledge and vision arose in me. Unprovoked is my release. What does that mean? It means that there's nothing left in the Buddha's mind now to provoke the birth of another moment rooted in ignorance. He has pierced the veil of ignorance. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. Again, he's not talking necessarily about not having another physical birth, although there's an aspect of that. This is the last birth, meaning there's nothing left in him to provoke the birth of another moment rooted in ignorance, taken in context of what he's saying, and even in the same paragraph. There is now no further becoming. Again, related to the teachings on the three suttas on becoming, the title of my book, there's nothing left in him to become further ignorant. There is now no further becoming. Then I had the thought, this Dhamma that I have attained is deep, hard to see, and hard to realize. This Dhamma is peaceful, refined, beyond mere conjecture. This Dhamma is subtle and is to be directly experienced by the wise, you could say, or by the noble ones. But the world delights in attainment, is excited by attachment, is devoted to attachment, and worships attachment. And don't we do that? For a world delighting in attachment, excited by attachment, devoted to attachment, worshiping attachment, and conditioned towards self-identification from dependence on ignorance, this Dharma is hard to see. Meaning a mind rooted in ignorance is going to have a very difficult time developing this pure Dharma. The Buddha continues, the awakened state is also hard to realize. The awakened state is the resolution of all fabrications. Remember, dependent origination states from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. From that fabricated mind state comes the all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. So that the Buddha is speaking to the root of the problem of ignorance. The relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, the development of dispassion for self-identification. The development of cessation, the development of unbinding. You can see how these relate also to Four Noble Truths. If I were to teach the Dhamma and others would not understand me, that would be troublesome for me. It's an interesting thing from an awakened human being. He's evaluating very clearly now because he understood his own, what he had to go through to develop his understanding. And now he's evaluating, can I even teach this? And if my decision is that I can't teach it, it's basically a waste of time. It'll be tiresome for me. It'll be troublesome for me because it won't reach the goal of simply teaching other human beings how to do what he did. And he decides, the Buddha's words, I'll dismiss teaching that which only with great difficulty I attained. This Dhamma is not easily realized by those overcome with the defilements, overcome with greed, aversion, and delusion. That's also, now we can take that as encouragement, can't we, when we're struggling with developing the Dhamma ourselves. even the Buddha realized that those of us that are stuck in the three defilements, at least temporarily, are going to have a difficult time. It's to be expected, isn't it? Unless you're Kandana or Lorna. This Dhamma is difficult to understand, subtle, deep, contrary to common belief. And it still is, isn't it? Those delighting in passion, their minds obsessed in darkness, will not understand. So there's got to be some way of getting past that. So I'm going to read my comments here. The following portion of this sutta uses metaphor to portray a significant realization that arose in Siddhartha's, now a Buddha, and awaken human beings' mind. And so that's often, that is not often, that's the use of mara, to describe in a visual sense, in a pictorial sense, a quality of mind that may be more difficult to describe otherwise. The use of metaphor to portray troubled mind states or significant realizations is used throughout the Pali Canon. I've talked about that often. The Buddha continues, then Brahma Sahampati became aware of my thoughts. The world is lost, destroyed. The Arahant, the rightly self-awakened one, is inclined to dwelling in ease and not teaching his Dhamma. So you can see that the Buddha simply going over in his mind, he's having second thoughts about the decision not to teach the Dhamma. Brahma Sahampati, and that second thought is metaphorically Brahma Sahampati. Brahma Sahampati left his realm and came to me. He knelt on his right knee, bowed, and said, rightly self-awakened one, please teach your Dhamma. Please teach your Dhamma. There are those with just a little dust in their eyes. They are suffering because they will not hear your Dhamma. There are those that are able to understand. Brahma Sahampati continued, in the past, there appeared among the Magadhans an impure Dhamma devised by the ignorant. The Buddha is recounting his encounter with Alarakalama, Udeka Ramaputta, and other teachers and other practices. Teach your Dhamma to end the pain of birth, sickness, aging, and death. Teach your Dhamma to end sorrow, regret, distress, despair, to end greed, aversion, and delusion. Teach your Dhamma so they can also realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. Just as one standing on a high peak might see people below, you, the wise one, with profound vision, must take your place in the palace of the Dhamma. So whether there was a little bit of reluctance in Siddhartha Gautama, now the Buddha, in teaching himself, that reluctance might have been rooted in a little bit of false humility, it's gone now. The Buddha's teaching himself or using that metaphor to reaffirm in his own mind that you are worthy of teaching. You are noble now. Free from suffering, look on those suffering oppressed with birth and aging. You have conquered ignorance. Be a great teacher and wander without entanglements. Teach your Dhamma, there will be those who will understand. The Buddha continues, mindful of Sahampati's plea and out of compassion for all beings, from my awakened state, I looked out onto the world. I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and beings with much. I saw uncluttered beings and dull beings. I saw beings with good qualities and beings with bad qualities. I looked out onto the world and I saw beings hardened in these views, disgraced, endangered, the Loka Sutta. I looked out on the world and the world was aflame. I looked out onto the world and I saw those who would be easy to teach my understanding, my right view. It is as if a pond is permeated with red, white, and blue lotus, born and growing immersed in the water. They flourish permeated with cool water from their root to the tip, never standing above the surface. Even so, some might rise up and emerge from the murky water. You remember the Buddha used that same simile in some of the teachings on jhana. Seeing thus, I decided to teach my Dhamma, to open the world to the path to cessation. Those with eyes to see and ears to hear could come forth in conviction. Those lacking the eyes to see or the ears to hear the pure Dhamma, I would not teach my refined and pure Dhamma. That's not the Buddha saying, I'm going to withhold something from these people, he simply understands the profound nature of right speech. And wasting time and causing frustration and agitation to people who aren't ready to hear the Dhamma is an act of wrong speech. So he simply won't do it. I would teach the pure Dhamma tirelessly and untroubled. Brahmasahampati was pleased. He bowed and disappeared. The Buddha made his decision. Then the thought occurred to me, who should I first teach the Dhamma to? Who will quickly understand? I thought of Alarakalama, wise, intelligent, competent, but I heard that he had passed a week ago. I thought what a great loss it was to my friend Alara. He would have quickly learned my Dhamma. This is such a heartwarming, such a wonderful part of the teaching. The Buddha is acknowledging, he's not saying Alarakalama is anything. He didn't denigrate Alarakalama at all. In fact, out of this great now awakened compassion, he would hope to teach his teacher. But he remembered or he heard that Alarakalama passed. Then I thought of Udaka Ramaputta. He too was wise, intelligent, and competent. But I heard that he had passed just last night. It was a great loss to my friend Udaka as well. He too would have quickly learned my Dhamma. I then thought of the five friends I wandered with while attending the ascetic practices. I knew they were at Deer Park at Isipatana. I took my leave to wander in stages to Isipatana. Along the way, I encountered Upaka the Ajavika. He noted my composure, my complexion being bright. He inquired, on whose account have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? In whose Dhamma do you delight? I told Upaka, I have left the world behind through my own understanding. I am released from all wrong views, from all phenomena. Empty of ignorance, I am free of craving. My realization is taught by none. To whom should I declare as my teacher? I have no teacher, as one like me cannot be found. I have no counterpart, for I am an arahant in the world. I am the unexcelled teacher, rightly self-awakened. The fires of passion are cooled. I am unbound. I will set the wheel of the true Dhamma rolling. I am traveling to Kasi. In a world afflicted with the darkness of ignorance, I beat the drum of wisdom. Upaka replied, from what you claim, you must be the ultimate conqueror. The Buddha says, conquerors like me have abandoned greed, aversion, and delusion, meaning even the label of being the conqueror. I have conquered all evil qualities. You are correct, Upaka. I am a conqueror in that sense. Upaka, unconvinced, shaking his head, took his leave. He didn't believe him. So the Buddha's very first student didn't get it, did he? He didn't take that one could become rightly self-awakened. He wanted to hear, much like today, and I get asked this question more times than I wish, who's your teacher? What lineage do you practice? Meaning you're not authentic unless you can say so-and-so, some modern person, or maybe not Nagarjuna, but nobody would take that today. Who is your teacher? The Buddha says, I have no teacher. I'm a rightly self-awakened one. Upaka couldn't deal with that and went on his way, much like what occurs today. I continued to the Deer Park. From afar, my five friends saw me. I was no longer gaunt from ascetic self-denial. Thinking that I was living luxuriously, they decided to not show me respect. As I approached, they noticed my awakened state. Standing in respect, they took my robe and bowl and prepared a seat. One of my friends took a bowl and began to wash my feet. They, however, addressed me by my familiar name, meaning a show of disrespect. Friends, do not address the Tathagata, a rightly self-awakened one, in this way. I am rightly self-awakened, a worthy one. Listen carefully to my words. I have realized the unborn, the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. I will teach you my understanding. Practice as I instruct you, and shortly you will also realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. The group of five replied, from your practice of the austerities, you did not attain any superior state or any higher knowledge or vision worthy of a noble one, meaning the practices that they had condition themselves to believe ascetic practices, condition themselves to believe would lead to awakening, he abandoned them. And since he abandoned them, how could he possibly have developed awakening? He abandoned the only path that was going to develop awakening in their minds. It's just a perfect example of a mind rooted in ignorance, isn't it? How can you now, living luxuriously, straying from your exertion and backsliding into abundance, he's eating gruel and put on some dirty robes, attain any superior state or any higher knowledge or vision worthy of a noble one? I replied that Tathagata is not living luxuriously or strayed from his exertion or backslided into abundance. The Tathagata is a worthy one, a rightly self-awakened one. Listen carefully. I have realized the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. I will teach you my understanding. Practice as I instruct you, and shortly you will also realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding for yourselves right here and now. Just as he was telling his friends, he's telling us the same thing right here, right now in this room. A second and third time they doubted me and questioned me in the same manner. I then asked them, have I ever claimed to be rightly self-awakened one before? They replied, you have never before claimed to be rightly self-awakened. I replied again, the Tathagata is not living luxuriously or strayed from his exertion or backslided into abundance. The Tathagata is a rightly self-awakened one. Listen carefully. I have realized the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. I will teach you my understanding. Practice as I instruct you, and shortly you will also realize the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding for yourselves, right here and now. And so I convinced them of my knowledge and wisdom. Over time, living on alms, I instructed the group of five, being subject themselves to birth, to sickness, to aging, to death, to sorrow, regret, pain, distress, despair, to greed, to aversion, to delusion, and now, understanding the suffering of birth, of sickness, of aging, of death, of sorrow, regret, pain, distress, despair, of greed, of aversion, of delusion, they attain the unborn and the unexcelled release of the yoke, the unbinding. I'm just skipping over my comments there. The Buddha continues, friends, craving and clinging arises from the five senses. Now he's relating this to the five clinging aggregates. Forms known through the eye, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual pleasure. Sounds known from the ear, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual pleasure. Aromas known from the nose, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual pleasure. Tastes known from the tongue, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual pleasure. Tactile sensations known from the body, agreeable, pleasing, enticing, enchanting, are linked to sensual desire. This is the craving and clinging that arises from the five senses. So he's taking their minds that he knows are still somewhat stuck in these ascetic practices and other things they studied with some of the same teachers too, and he's turning it back to what's important to recognize and where to find the Dhamma. Any contemplative or Brahmin, any seeker who clings to sensuality in this manner, infatuated and enchanted with sensuality, without understanding the suffering that follows, or the path to cessation, should be known as unfortunate and having met their ruin. They have lost their minds, and the world will have its way with them. It is as if a wild deer were caught in a heap of snares. This deer has met misfortune and ruin. A hunter could do with that deer what they will. In the same manner, any contemplative, any Brahmin, any seeker, who clings to sensuality in this manner, infatuated and enchanted with sensuality, without understanding the suffering that follows or the path to cessation, should be known as unfortunates and having met their ruin. They have lost their minds, and the world will have its way with them, being ensnared or entangled with the world. Of course, the Buddha is not saying that we don't live in the world post-awakening. We simply leave behind craving for and clinging to the things of the world. If we don't, we're like that deer caught in the snares, and the world will have its way with us. And it does, doesn't it? Doesn't it have its way with us? We have lost control of our minds, and things happen to us that cause us to react rather than remain in peace.
We take the bait.
We take the bait constantly. And And really, the bait is at the end of our own fishing pole, isn't it? You know? The Buddha continues, "Now know this, friends. Any contemplative, any Brahmin, any seeker who no longer clings to sensuality in this manner, who's not infatuated or enchanted with sensuality, and understanding the suffering that follows from craving and clinging, and the path to cessation, should be known as fortunate and will not meet ruin." Another way of saying this is that the safest way we can live our lives is within the framework of the Eightfold Path. We'll free ourselves from the dangers of entanglement in the world. And in that way, we'll be able to live in the abundance of the world without being attached to it. And then every experience of that abundance in the world is meaningful without leading towards distraction, without leading towards more suffering. It's just a remarkable teaching. They have control of their minds, and the world will not have its way with them. It is as if a wild deer avoided a hunter's snares. This deer has not met misfortune and has avoided ruin. A hunter could not do with them what they will. In the same manner, any contemplative, any Brahmin, any seeker who does not cling to sensuality in this manner, practices restraint, is not infatuated or enchanted with sensuality, who understands the suffering that follows from craving and clinging and the path to cessation. They should be known as fortunate and will not meet ruin. They have control of their minds, and the world will not have its way with them. It is as if a wild deer is living carefree in all ways. Why is it carefree? Because it has gone beyond the hunter's range. In the same way, those engaged in the noble search, established in seclusion from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities, enter and remains in the first jhana. This first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. When we talked about this, we all do that in meditation, in right meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation. It is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. They have become lost to mara, lost to the effects of wrong views. Furthermore, those engaged in the noble search enter and remain in the second jhana. This second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration, free of directed thought and evaluation. With internal assurance, the joy of concentration permeates their entire mind and body. They have become lost to mara, lost to the effects of wrong views. The Buddha's teaching his five friends now that the meditation methods that they have been practicing were rudeness is kind of response to what I said to Ram before earlier, were rooted in only that first jhana, and there's still directed thought and evaluation in that. He's now instructing them that there's deeper concentration. But if you didn't know that, if a mind rooted in ignorance wouldn't naturally go towards deeper concentration unless it understood that, yes, there is deeper concentration, much like the Anupada Sutta, all of the suttas on jhana, but in that one where the Buddha used Sariputta as the example of each level of jhana, he understood yet that there was a deeper level of jhana. The Buddha's teaching this probably for the first time, well, it is for the first time, to these five friends that he had wandered around. There's deep. What he's saying is the meditation that you've been doing, it's not quite it. There's deeper levels to go. Furthermore, those engaged in the noble search enter and remain in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. Much like David said too before, the noble search includes being mindful of the deepening levels of jhana and developing those.
You can almost say ignoble seems harsh, but there's a right jhana and there's an appropriate.
Yeah, and you could use those words, appropriate search and inappropriate search.
No, literally,
but,
why is it just makes sense to use the two?
I thought about changing that. And the reason why I didn't is the relation to the noble ones, meaning awakened ones, and how the Four Noble Truths is accurately classified as Four Noble Truths.
I mean, he's really making a stand.
Yeah.
This is the right way. This is the noble way.
Yeah.
Anything else is not.
Yes. And we don't, you know, we're a little bit... most of us, myself included, are sensitive towards saying something is ignoble or someone is ignoble, but or even someone, it happened a few times here, calling someone foolish. But always this is in reference to the Dhamma and not to someone's being. In other words, if you're a Dhamma practitioner and you think that 300 jumping jacks you need to do every day, that's foolish as far as it relates to the Dhamma. It doesn't mean the person is foolish. And the same as if you're a Dhamma practitioner, if you're looking to develop the awakening that a Buddha teaches, it's noble to practice what the Buddha taught, and it's ignoble to not. And that's, and it's, again, it's in the context. If you decide that you are someone who really favors Alara Kalama, there's nothing, you know, there's no denigration attached to you going and practicing with Alara Kalama. But if you ask me, meaning the Buddha, what is the noble path and what is the ignoble path? The ignoble path is Alara Kalama. And how do I know? And he's not even denigrating Alara Kalama by saying that, is he? Because he, even in the sutta, he's showing the high regard that he has for Alara Kalama. He just taught something different, that's all. And so we use words to describe that.
He would be one with some dust in their eye, that if they had the chance, they would have awakened.
That's, yeah, just as the Buddha said, if you know, if I could have got to him just a couple of weeks ago, he would have had a chance. And again, he's also teaching, much like the Bahia Sutta, he's also teaching us, aren't we? We don't know, you know, we might only have a week, we might only have a day left. Take to the Dhamma and awaken, right here and right now. He references that.
Would the meaning that was sort of coming out to me in this was worthy or unworthy? I mean, I know that's maybe a harsh word as well.
Yeah.
Worth your concentration would be the Eightfold Path. And as he says, things that are subject to birth are ignoble. That
yep.
really stuck out to me when it, you know, that it's very clear and direct.
Yeah. And so that, I mean, the Buddha teaches just that in many suttas, including this one, that seeking happiness in what is subject to birth, sickness, aging and death, to sorrow, regret, pain, etc., is ignoble. Anytime you do it, you can expect to be disappointed, or, well, you will be disappointed, but you are likely going to be distracted away from awakening. And so it's ignoble as opposed to noble. It does not mean that you are somehow less of a human being or anything else, because the Buddha's not making that comment. He's speaking, and again, remember the setting? He's speaking strictly in the context of the Dhamma. Helen?
Doesn't it, part of it was there are the understanding that there are deeper jhanas.
Yes.
And then in the second jhana, doesn't it say something about sort of being devoid of judgment?
Yep.
You're not judging.
Yep.
So that sort of...
Yeah, thank you for that. So because the Buddha has reached that point of being free of judgment, he's simply describing what's present, isn't he? And nowhere does he say, if you're engaged in an ignoble search, you're such and such and such. In the context of the Dhamma, there's ignoble searches, there's noble searches. That's all. And it is an important point, because this is one of the things I think that has led to this modern Dhamma that is afraid to tell it like it is. You know, and it's all just about feeling wonderful all the time. And there's all things reconcile into this grand place of nothingness, but where there's pure bliss and happiness forever and ever and ever. The Buddha never taught any of that stuff. It's such a nice distraction, isn't it? To follow something along those ways. Very similar. In that way, modern Buddhism has more akin to the Vedas and the Upanishads, modern Hinduism. And it's also very similar to most religions, aren't they? They promise a reward if you act a certain way or do a certain thing or whatever you might do. But nowhere is it really taught to change the way you look at yourself in relation to the world, the three insights.
And he keeps saying, this works, that
yeah.
does not work. That's the difference.
Yeah, and he always held himself out as a rightly self-awakened one, meaning that he did it. He never ever said that I came from I came from some Buddhist heaven down here to teach you poor infidels. He was always held himself out as a human being who figured it out, and now if you want to learn, listen, just like he's telling his friends. And they wanted something, they wanted to see a godlike Siddhartha to prove that he was ready to teach them, rather than simply this friend that they had who figured it out. And until he could, until they relented and let go of that little bit of conditioned thinking, they weren't able to learn the Dhamma either. What a great discussion. Thank you for inspiring it. Let me finish it up. Furthermore, those engaged in the noble search enter and remain in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. They have become, now using the metaphor again, they have become lost to Mara, meaning this, the metaphor of Mara can no longer find you anywhere. There's no longer any ignorance left. They have become lost to Mara, lost to the effects of wrong views. Furthermore, those engaged in the noble search enter and remain in the fourth jhana, which is pure equanimity. Pure equanimity and mindful. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness. They have become lost completely to Mara, lost to the effects of wrong view. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with complete abandonment of self-identification to form, with the fading of aversion, with the cessation of craving here and there, they enter and remain in the dimension of the infinitude of space. Now, it should be carefully taught that the Buddha is not teaching that this is another deeper level of jhana. It just fits in the teaching. It fits in the teaching as these ever-deepening levels of jhana. The Buddha is a little bit more expansive on this in the Anupada Sutta, where he's holding Sariputta out. These are simply fabricated mind states to be recognized and abandoned, and again, taken into context with this whole sutta. Craving here and there, they enter and remain in a dimension of infinite space. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with complete abandon of the dimension of infinite space, they enter and remain in the dimension of infinite consciousness. They have become lost to Mara, etc., etc. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with complete abandonment of the dimension of infinite consciousness, they enter and remain in the dimension of infinite nothingness. And the Buddha goes through this. Oh, let me read it. It's not that much more. I was going to say, all of these non-physical realms that people during the Buddha's time and still today aspire to, thinking that they're higher forms of understanding, the Buddha is simply saying they're impermanent and they're rooted in fabrications. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with complete abandonment of the dimension of nothingness, they enter and remain in the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. They have become lost to Mara, lost to the effects of wrong view. And further still, those engaged in the noble search with complete abandonment of the dimensions of, and I'm just going to say the dimensions previously mentioned, these non-physical dimensions. Sorry, I lost my space. They enter and remain in the cessation of perception and feeling. The cessation of perception and feeling. Rooted in what? Rooted in ignorance. This is the foundation for fabrications, isn't it? By recognizing all of these different levels of jhana and understanding, like he taught Sariputta, there is yet still deeper concentration. And recognizing and abandoning the aspiration to acquire an establishment in non-physical realms, once these are recognized and abandoned, they enter and remain in the cessation of perception and feeling. There's just pure abiding. And whether we in our meditation practice find ourselves aspiring to, given non-physical realms, like, well, I just found myself in the realm of infinite consciousness, and I think I talked about that a couple weeks ago. I had an experience that I would describe that way. I actually had a few of them. Or I'm now in infinite space, you know, this feeling of spaciousness, really no frame of reference in that. Or whatever other non-physical realms we might find ourselves in, or maybe even developed ourselves through some teaching, to recognize that they're fabricated. And what do we do when we're in our meditation practice And we find ourselves suddenly in this, in the realm of infinite consciousness. And it feels wonderful, and it feels spacious. It feels like bliss. It feels like attainment. What do? Remember what the Buddha taught, and come back to your breath and deepen your concentration. Because if you're in that place, your mind is not concentrated. It's distracted. And it's distracted by an acquisition.
And you will know soon, because you will pop right out of it.
You'll pop right out of it. But if you're engaged in a practice that encourages that, and you know, many of them, you will find, and you may even have a teacher that will, if you answer the question, and it's always, it's usually a hidden question, and your response might be to this teacher, I found myself in the dimension of infinite consciousness, etc., etc. That teacher might take it on themselves to give you a ceremony. He might touch you on the forehead or touch their head to yours and say, I now give you my transmission. That is often the case in what is called transmitting the Dhamma, or the Dharma in that sense. All that they're doing is validating a fabricated quality of mind, aren't they?
John, do you have to get to that point to truly have the level of concentration to understand the three marks?
No, and thank you for the question. Because of the position in the teaching, where it arrives, it can seem like that. And I wondered about, I looked for a way with, or a sutta where the Buddha didn't teach it in that way. In other words, he started a teaching on jhana or concentration as first you get rid of this. It's always taught this way. And I think it's just really a convention when you see it in the context of what he's teaching. There's these ever deepening levels of jhana, including that fourth level, and yet there's still ever deepening concentration. And so if you find yourselves in these other levels, simply recognize that. That they're fabricated mind states. Excuse me. They're fabricated mind states to be recognized and abandoned. Period. Not recognized, talked about, massaged a little bit, feel good about, recognize and abandon. Why? Because they're simply fabricated mind states. There's no attainment. There's no value in it. The devalue in it would be clinging to it and thinking you've accomplished something. Again, you read how the Buddha taught these, in the context that he taught, and then in the overarching context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. There's nothing in these non-physical realms, is there, that relate to that at all. And then in this sutta, the Buddha particularly and specifically points out, I attained these states prior to his awakening and realized they weren't anything. And he asked that direct question, are these non-physical states the culmination of your teaching? And they said, yes. He says, no, that's not it. I want more than that. Let me finish this up, and maybe we'll have time to meditate. The Buddha continues, free of reaction, knowledge and wisdom well established, greed, aversion, and delusion are completely overcome. They have become lost to Mara, lost to the effects of wrong views. Having engaged in a noble search, they are unattached to anything in the world or fabricated from worldly influences. They are as carefree as a deer, far removed from a hunter's range. Why are they as carefree as a deer, far removed from a hunter's range? Because they have completed the noble search and through their own efforts have gone beyond Mara's reach, meaning the reach of ignorance. Mara is always a metaphor for ignorance. Gone beyond Mara's reach. They have gone beyond the reach of ignorance. Those who have engaged in the noble search, who have completed the Eightfold Path, are said to be rightly self-awakened. This is what the great teacher said. The group of five were delighted from hearing these words. Thank you for listening to this sutta in two parts. Isn't it just remarkable how it so focuses our Dhamma and allows us or directs us towards the Eightfold Path and nothing else. Don't embellish it. Don't adapt it. Don't accommodate it in any way. I think before we meditate, we'll just go around the room briefly, and then we'll meditate and close with metta, like we always do. So, Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here, as always. It's been a wonderful sutra to listen to. Very inspiring, really is. And to think that he was just an ordinary man, you know, and he just had that life, and as it was told that we've listened to, and he figured it out through his own understanding of what it isn't, you know, which led him to the understanding of what it is. Just so such a clever, observant, humane person. As I say, very inspiring. And then I was thinking about what Helen said last week about a train journey. She said that, you know, like when you're on the train and it's going at 60, 70 miles an hour and you're looking at the scenery going by and it just goes by so quickly you can't sort of focus on anything, so you just go a bit of a blind blur in your mind and you're just watching it but not focusing on anything. And I thought, oh, really, that's just how life is, that if you can see that our own lives are going by in just the same manner but a lot slower. And because it's so slow that we can latch onto it and get feelings about things, and it's really exactly the same as sitting in the train at 70 miles an hour or doing it all at walking speed. The situation is still the same, but the 70 miles an hour, when you don't have time to focus on it because there's something coming, you don't focus on it. And yet when we're going at normal life speed, which is a lot slower, that it's then that we just get all hooked up about stuff and just sort of get embedded in stuff that we, in our minds, that so I reflected on that this week. So thank you, Helen.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Lorna. Yeah, the Buddha search is just like our search, isn't it? You know, we won't encounter Alara Kalama or Dekarama Putta, but we may encounter similar teachings. Or it may be that we had no spiritual or religious inclination at all until we came to the Dhamma, but we were still enamored and distracted and entangled with the world, weren't we? We were worshiping, as the Buddha says here, we were worshiping the things of the world. And so, in that way, we might be searching for happiness in just the things of the world. It's okay too. Or we might be searching for happiness in philosophies that aren't the same as the Buddha's. And as the Buddha teaches, that if we're looking where happiness, where understanding can't be found, we won't find it. If we're looking to impermanent and fabricated things, we can't find understanding there. But if we look within the framework of the Eightfold Path, literally what we're doing is looking at our own views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we can awaken. And how do we know that? How do we understand that? Because there's an Eightfold Path. It shows us the difference between a wrong view and a right view, a right action and a wrong action, a skillful or an unskillful action, or a noble or an ignoble action. Ron, good to see you.
Good to be here. Yeah, I remember a lot of train rides, and as we're talking about this, I realized that when you're actually sitting there in the train and you're looking out, it's quite pleasant to just look and let it run by. And actually, it's quite unpleasant to try and focus on things. And real life is the same way. If you can let things just go by, that's pretty pleasant abiding.
It is.
As soon as you start to, oh my God, my kids are growing up, or stop that now, enjoy that a little bit more. That's when it gets uncomfortable.
Rip your arms off if you keep hanging on to
it.
Train is heavy. Train is heavy.
That's exactly it. That's craving and clinging, isn't it?
Craving and clinging.
Recognize it, let it go. Because it only hurts, it's painful.
I did see that when he starts describing, when he finally comes to that place where he does his final meditations, that he's describing a pleasant abiding,
yeah,
where he is. So that's already an indication that he's just given up completely on the ascetic side of it.
Yeah.
And that you can do the noble search. It doesn't have to be unpleasant.
It doesn't have to be at all, and it can be done at any point.
In a place of ease.
Yeah, the relevance of that is that you don't have to go through what the Buddha did, or I did, or anybody else did. You start with the Dhamma right here, right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, to me, that's remarkable too, because the legends are for this endless, arduous search, fighting dragons every step of the way. Sit down, find a secluded spot, and do jhana. Incorporate the Eightfold Path. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Matt and I were talking about this, and it, there's a context of the householder in this sutta. That's just like what you were saying. So there's just so much going on in this sutta. I mean, really,
yeah,
grateful that you're teaching it, and it's nice to be a student to something of this scale. Especially what it's bringing up for me is the ignoble and noble searches. It's just natural to bring that up, especially when you hit certain times of your life, whether they're in years or accomplishments or whatever they are. It's just natural. Right now in my life, that's pretty much front and center. Every moment is noble search or ignoble search. It's not a lot of people are going to understand it, and that's really refreshing and comforting. That I felt a lot of taking refuge in the Buddha in this sutta as well.
You don't really
hear a lot of his own insights or experiences, but this one particularly, it's shining a little onto that, and the Dhamma as well. So I don't expect people to understand it, and it's really comforting to hear the Buddha teach that, because not a lot of people are going to understand it. If, like you said, you're distracted and rooted in ignorance that you can't see, and you're continually creating strategies to not see, you won't see. It's going to be tough. But that's why we do it.
Thank you. Yeah, there's just as the Buddha realized, there's very few people with just a speck of dust in their eyes. And that's just the way it is. It's not, those with lots of specks, that's, there's nothing wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going to be very difficult to develop the Dhamma, that's all. Mary, good to see you.
It's good to be here. Very good to be here. Gosh, there's so much in here. It feels really good to hear this, the parts that are easier to understand because maybe you've had a glimpse or some direct experience with it, and then the parts that you're like, okay, it's refreshing to know there's more work to be done here. And that you're up for the challenge. I just think there are so many, for some reason I kept thinking about, raising children, that, there's often an occasion that somebody wanted to do something, or friends were doing something, or whatever. And, we would talk about, can do that. That doesn't mean you should do that. Like, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And because I at the time of raising my children, I wasn't necessarily thinking about the Buddha, but the whole idea that it won't lead to the goal. Like, you can do these things, or even friends of mine that might do something, or myself. And you justify, you rationalize that you want to do something or follow something or behave a certain way or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's a good reminder that just because you can doesn't mean you should. I guess I'm repeating it because it's just very practical. Like, I think we could all sort of understand that.
Yeah.
It won't lead to the goal, and the more and the quicker that we can sort of recognize that in our own peaceful way off of the cushion, it'll help redirect us and to keep us on the path. you know?
Yeah.
So wonderful, Sutta. I'm so glad I was here to hear it.
Thank you. And what a wonderful description of restraint that you just described. Mm. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. You know? That's even a better way. I'm gonna make that a teaching. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
I'm sure I didn't invent it. I'm sure I heard it somewhere.
Yeah. Cross River Meditation bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Dollar a piece.
That's a good idea.
But
that's
they're
two,
in
two,
it's,
two
it's
great
still
ideas.
Donna, though. Yeah, helping people out with that.
Yeah. Yeah. But they only last a few hours because they're impermanent.
Yes.
And they're gone. And then you need another one.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, that's marketing Buddha style, right? You'll need another one, bumper sticker.
David, good to see you tonight.
This sutta, along with others that incorporate three gems, are among my favorite. Because each one starts with him joining the Sangha and observing and seeing that they're acting properly and they're concentrated. And then the example of the Buddha teaching his Dhamma, the right Dhamma, the Dhamma. And that's what I see when I read the one from today. It's just reinforces. Here's this man who's an example for you. Here's these teachings that are the middle way. It's not extreme. And for those who are paying attention in the Sangha, there's no reason why they can't attain wisdom.
Yeah.
So that's, I truly appreciate this teaching.
Thank you. Thank you for those words. That's it, isn't it? You know, we are so fortunate that these clear teachings are still here. And I think, you know, not to speak for you, but I think I can. We all got so much out of the sutta. And think about, it was first given 2,600 years ago and probably a few translations ago, and it still has such meaning.
Well, because there was chaos then. We've talked several times lately about just reminding ourselves that it's no different now than it's ever been. When you think about, David knows a lot more about history than I do, but you think about different scenes or periods of time, it was all very chaotic.
Yeah, it was.
People trying to get places and, like you saying, someone wants more coconuts in their camp than someone else. I mean, that's always been, you know. So, very helpful.
It is. I couldn't help but think about what today is in our country. And if the Buddha was here, or someone, or they listened to someone at least as wise as the Buddha, and how he would say to the Democrats and to the Republicans, you know, one of you is going to win. And when you win, treat the other ones like this,
right,
which is how, instead of, you know, I don't think that's going to happen, but maybe, you know. that's the wisdom of the Dhamma, isn't it? It would recognize, he wouldn't say you're both wrong, he would recognize one side is going to win in this particular situation. Treat the other one within the framework of with right speech, right action, and right livelihood.
It goes back to what you said last week to me. Act wisely, act with skillfulness.
Yeah.
That someone's going to be disappointed tomorrow.
Yeah.
So what do you do? Get on the roof and scream, or do you...
Or gloat.
Yeah.
Or take advantage of it, or anything, you know.
Right.
So that's what I took from last week, was, you know, stay on the path that's...
Yeah. And that's what I mean. What do we do? You started that discussion about, you know, what do we do off our cushion? Well, be an example this way, you know. And imagine if we had, I'm not putting down our current president. I don't think that's right. But imagine if we had an awakened one in the White House and said, okay, well, the other side won, you know, good for you, or we won. Let's treat the other side with respect instead of words and hurtful action. Pardon me?
Or at least do no harm.
Yeah, or at least imagine that. I mean, one of the things that I did spend, today was my day to spend a little time on TV, which was too much time. And I heard, you know, someone saying as soon as we get in power, the first thing we're going to do is impeach him, take him to court and try him. And, boy, maybe that's necessary, but that's the one thing you're thinking about when you become a representative of this country is to do that. What about, you know, I got into a political thing. The point is that an awakened mind would seek that balanced response to really, it would be, okay, I won, how can I help you? Okay, I lost, how can I help you? You know? Instead of, and so, again, excuse the political speech, I didn't mean it to be that way. I meant it to be as an example of how this works and why it works. I think it's the only thing that does work.
Well, I have a business example. In my business, we gain new business, which usually means, because it's a saturated market, that somebody's losing business. Mm. So we went on to a site where the incumbent is still present, and we're getting ready because we'll be taking it over December 1st. And the manager decided to be very hostile. And so and typically the hourly employees would come and work for us. So that as little impact for the hourly employees while they change firms that come in to manage the place. And so my manager called me, and she's, you know, had never, you know, this was a first for her. And, you know, and I just guided her saying, you know, his hostility doesn't change anything. You still have to stay on your path to get what you have to get done there today and to get this information to the employees. But you can't absorb what hostility that he's showing you. And we, in our company, will not go to that level of animosity between our firms. It was just, you know, unprofessional. But that's just one example. I'm sure that happens in everybody's lives every day. We don't even have to go to a political example to find where people will go there. And if you can bring a middle way to it and muddle through and still get your job done, is the goal.
Yeah. And that all comes down to individuals letting go of self-referential views rooted in ignorance of four noble truths.
Right. Because at first she took it very personally. Oh my God, what did I do?
And that permeates society. You know, I love sports, and my father was a big sport. He was a semi-pro football player and semi-pro baseball player, wrestler, all this stuff. Good guy though, but very, very competitive. And so he wanted his sons to be that way. And I loved sports, and I especially love football. But I made the freshman team in high school. But at that level, and really for the first time, the idea of winning at all costs really became paramount. And it just disgusted me. And so I stopped playing because I enjoyed the game. I loved running around and catching a ball and all that stuff. But the idea that I had to constantly be defeating someone to make it worthwhile, you know, and even when I started, I ended up being a golfer for much of my life when I could still play. And I loved playing competitive golf, but not against competitive people, you know, and just go out there and enjoy the game. And if you happen to win a free beer or something, that was great. But this whole idea of having to beat somebody to prove your own worth is always bothersome to me. You know?
I see it now from just the sort of the academic side of the game of golf, being a rater of courses people, why are they attached to these, you know, have to play the top 100 like it's some badge. Like I'm a member of a group, and they gave a guy an award for achieving the top 100. I'm just like, you know, that's not really what it's about.
But yeah.
That's cool. Good job. You know, but you're probably missing the top 100 if you're worried about your little award. You know, probably got to go do it again because you didn't.
Yeah,
get it.
And so the award is the ultimate distraction, isn't it?
Because
it's got my name on it.
Yeah.
Wow, we have such great discussions, but it's good to see Helen tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here. Not to jump back into the political arena again, but our brother is
up for election tonight in our brother,
Wow.
Yeah. He's running for an assembly seat in Tulsa.
That's pretty good restraint that he doesn't know that. See us.
We haven't been marching with the posters.
Yeah.
We haven't been wearing
anyway,
t-shirts.
John, my brother John, is one of those people who can talk to people on both sides
right.
because he's brilliant. And he can understand where someone is coming from. He also has a great sense of humor. He's very witty and very quick. And so he can present his side in a non-threatening way.
Oh.
And one of the videos of him campaigning showed him going to a door and introducing himself and engaging this person. And the person says to him, "Well, you're a Democrat, aren't you?" And this is Tulsa, which is, you know, Oklahoma is pretty red. And he said, just like that, he says, "Yes, I hope you won't hold that against me." You know, so there was that like opening for a non-threatening discussion.
Yeah.
And that's what we need more of. You know,
yeah.
Not, it can take the ego out of it.
Yeah.
If we could just annihilate the ego, the world would be a better place.
I agree.
Even
admittedly,
you know.
What's his last name?
Walter.
Oh, okay.
Walter. Yeah,
I got to look.
Seventh District.
Yeah, I'm gonna try
He'll
to.
You'll hear a loud whoop once the results come in.
Yeah.
You know, in Hunterdon County, you'll hear a loud whoop.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's actually on a televised program tonight.
HBO.
Followed him around and
yeah. Wow.
Broadcast. You know,
cool.
So.
He was on the Diane Rehm show.
He's one of the part of the teacher Tom activists. going out across the
country. He was in.
All right, let's
move
on.
Yeah.
I'm
going to vote for him. So.
Well, on our Facebook page, I'm sure everybody is like, okay. You don't really have a whole good for you.
That's great. I hope he wins.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, why could I vote? Vote early, vote often. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Using the train analogy, some days we're on top of the train, some days we're in the train, some days the train passes us by.
Yep.
Maybe that's what Polar Express is about.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Sometimes
I think
we're
I have.
On top of the train and the train.
Oh, that with Ernest Borgnine, that movie?
No,
yeah.
This is
no.
I was
no, that was in North.
Yeah, I was thinking of the remake, but it
Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks in there.
Yeah.
But the book is wonderful.
Children's book.
Yeah.
So you were saying, Liz, about the train.
I'm just trying to find a way to segue back into my amazing brother. No, I'm kidding.
Get on. Go to Oklahoma.
I heard you have a brother running for Congress.
Oh, as a matter of fact, we do.
Anyway.
Does he watch these videos? We could say hello anyway.
Yeah, we could.
Hello, John.
He did a live conversation from Tally's, which is a diner that's been around since the 60s. It's on Route 66, so it's called Tally's. He did a rally from Tally's.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, so some days, you know, are better than others, and this is just a good reminder to, you know, just keep bringing it back to the breath and to all the practical guidelines that have been set up for us. You know, this man that figured this out, you have to wonder how his brain was structured to think about all these different things on all these different levels. Because I think molecularly, when you're in that state of abiding, there must be a different chemistry going on in your body too. So I look forward to that chemical reaction.
Well, one thing that I
no
do.
No stress hormones.
Pardon me?
It's a no stress hormones,
right?
Yeah.
Hormones.
When I'm meditating and I realize my mind is wandering off, I recognize the rising and the passing, but if it's one of those worms that gets in your brain where you think of all your troubles or all your worries or all your concerns, one thing I do is I smile and I say, I'm
gotcha. And
that's
then
great.
The smiling sends a message to your brain too, and kind of turns it around.
Yeah.
And then I can just go back to my breath again. So that's just to get back to the chemistry of it. That's one little thing that I do.
Yeah, that I usually give the instructions, this is going back quite a few years now, to begin meditation, to put a smile on your face.
Mm-hmm. Smile gently.
Smile. Yeah. Yeah, because it does. When you smile, it helps just relax your face and relax everything. So maybe I'll start incorporating that.
Going back to the sutta, deepening your concentration.
Yeah.
Right, because you're letting go of other things, so now I'm going to deepen my concentration.
Yeah, and it's a pleasant abiding. That idea of how brilliant Siddhartha was could lead to the question, so why was he so brilliant? And that's a question that he would say you just ignore, because it implies that there's something outside of him imposing brilliance, when the fact is, and I'm reading Stephen Hawking's last book that was published after he died, and it's just remarkable. He's just one of those guys you wish you could have at least had 5 minutes to talk, even if it was, you know, how's your day? But, and this is a chapter on, is God real? I can't remember the actual title of it. And the usual justification for God, or the ultimate justification for God, is this had to come from something. And another way of saying it is these views had to come from somewhere, or this experience had to come from somewhere. And he said, no, it doesn't. He said, the experience is here because the experience is here. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what the Buddha taught. Once you go beyond that, once you start asking those questions, the question yourself is what's confusing you. Mm-hmm. The whole Dhamma is about, this is what's occurring.
You find out that why is not really the question.
It's the most confusing question there is.
Mm-hmm.
I think I must have said this once or twice, because I talk about it. My friend, Brother Ken, who was a Jesuit monk, and I used to go visit him up in, there used to be a monastery just south of Newton on 206, gone now, beautiful place. And I'd go up there maybe once a month, usually on a Friday evening, because he was free, and we'd have these great discussions about God and the universe and where things are. I know it's gotten a little bit late, but Brother Ken had what they called then, I don't know what they call now, he had 9 nervous breakdowns. I don't know what the word is now. And he was the most grounded person I ever met. And he used to say, if you lose your mind, so what? You just get another one. But these discussions would often get down to this one point, and he'd say, John, and I'd go, Ken, why this? Why that? Why do babies die? Why? And he'd say, John, do not ask why. He says, that was my biggest problem. If you want to lose your mind, ask why. Isn't that brilliant?
Mm-hmm.
Because it really is, the question why, unless you're Stephen Hawking, is really why is this happening? Or why can't this be different?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than
why
just a clear observation,
right,
of this is what's
exactly
occurring.
Why can't this be different?
Yeah.
Right.
That's the question.
Yeah, and that was really the question I was asking. Why can't it be different that... I'm going to get into such, why can't things be different? They can't. How could they be different? They already are. You know, they're there. And that's what the Buddha recognized.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that, in fact, an understanding of the 3 marks, including impermanence, doesn't mean that the next moment might be surprising in its difference to what's been occurring, but you just don't know. And if you want to be present for that surprising new moment, you got to be well concentrated, don't you?
It's also relief to, I remember early on coming here, and it was such a relief not to carry that weight of why,
yeah,
or where, or how, or, and to just let the permission to let things just be was something I needed to hear.
Yeah.
And it was just such a relief, like, you know, like just taking heavy baggage off of you to say,
yeah,
I don't have to figure
the yoke
it out. I don't need to know the source of that answer. I just need to recognize it for what it is and then let it go and come back. I mean, that's just so freeing.
It is. A mind rooted in ignorance of 4 noble truths, rooted in the wrong view, sees itself as the center of the universe in most cases.
Right.
And so you have to know everything, don't you? Including the answers to all the endless whys. And when you come to this, you realize That's just a wrong view.
And with Google,
yeah, you know it all anyway.
You have to show restraint all the time. You need to know that. I don't have to know what causes, you know.
That's the next ultimate.
Foot injury.
I'm reading another book by this guy. I would call him a philosophical economist, but he's writing about these things that we think are so part of our society. And the book is called After Google or Beyond Google, including and specifically Google. In 5 or 10 years, they're going to be gone. There'll be something else that is just as big. And so, and he's not saying we shouldn't worry about it. He said we should be very worried about the centralization of information. And his ultimate solution, Gilbert, I can't think of his last name, is like the blockchain. Bitcoin is a blockchain economy, is the blockchain repository of our own personal understandings and our own personal information. It should be distributed rather than centralized.
Yeah.
That's something else, but it's a brilliant idea. Pardon me?
Civic. They have that. They have that. It's called Civic. There's something that's along those lines.
Oh.
There's things out there like that.
I wonder if it's any, because I only read about half his book and then Stephen Hawking's book arose. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you too. I don't have anything to add tonight, but thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.